Naturally Speaking.
Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Naturally Speaking podcast. In this episode, James Grecian and myself, James Buckley, chat science and policy with five researchers associated with the Institute.
Naturally Speaking. Naturally
Speaking. We're just going to quickly go around the table and allow everyone to introduce themselves briefly with just a few lines about who they are and what they do inside the Institute here in Glasgow.
I'm Sophie Elliott. I'm a PhD student within the Institute looking at Gadoid Habitat Association.
I'm David Bailey. I'm Sophie's PhD supervisor. I'm a marine biologist working here in the Institute.
Rodney Beard. My background's in economics, but I work within the Institute on disease modelling.
I'm Lisa Bowden. I'm a veterinary epidemiologist. I am working up in the vet school and work for a centre of expertise on animal disease outbreaks.
I'm Katie Hampson. I'm an ecologist in the Institute and I work on the disease rabies.
So given that science and policy is such a large subject, we thought we'd kind of talk about it in a broader scale to start with and then maybe see how the discussion goes and focus in on a few points towards the end. So we're going to start with Sophie and Lisa. In kind of policy making, what is it with science that you're really looking for? Is it specific ideas or general topics?
I think it's quite topic specific. I worked for Government Quango on marine conservation, and we were working to develop a network of marine protected areas and also working to develop targets and indicators under the Marine Strategy Framework Directive. So in our case, it was quite specific to those sort of areas.
Was the idea brought up by the policy? Did the policymakers in this case say, we want to set up marine protected areas? Or were scientists perhaps suggesting that this was necessary? How did that came about?
From my opinion, it comes from sort of legislation being put in place. This will be implemented through stakeholders and the public. And then my role at that time was to help the organisation forward and develop this into a policy, so it was actually understandable. A key example was that we'd look at scientific research on fishing impacts. And actually working in a government agency, that was quite difficult information to get hold of, especially case-specific information.
So is that when you come and talk to scientists, try and get science involved?
Yes, we'd organise meetings to discuss such. For example, we looked at impacts on burrowed mud habitats, and yes, we had to organise workshops with scientists.
I guess it's kind of one of the interesting things that we have with the science policy interface is that scientists will often think that they, you know, have the most and the best information that they've been collecting. It's really detailed and really specific. But actually, from the policy and if you like the Quango point of view, the scientist is just kind of one stream of evidence that you've got. You've also got, in the case of the marine framework, you've also got fishermen that are going out and have a stakeholder interest. You've got members of the public. There's a whole range of other bodies that have kind of that feed into this policy framework.
Yeah, and anything we produced would have to be out to public consultation. So you would get both the NGOs and the fishermen commenting on anything that was produced, saying that, for example, there wasn't enough evidence or there wasn't enough being done.
So it's perhaps important to, as scientists, to realise that you're not necessarily going to be, you're not as important perhaps as you think. Your scientific evidence may be reliable, robust, informative, but it doesn't necessarily mean that will directly influence.
It could influence.
But it could.
It could influence, and it does influence. Just there's more going on than simply the science.
Seems that the fishermen are getting a lot more switched on about looking for holes in evidence as well. The fishermen's organisations, some of them employ their own scientists as well. And so they're very clever about spotting gaps. And where a policy is supposed to be evidence-led, they can identify places where it's opinion-led rather than evidence-led. And they're quite able to identify those and pick them up. And you know, that could be the basis of a legal challenge to a policy later on. And that's been a big deal in the English MPA, Marine Protected Area system, where they had a whole load of marine protected areas which were identified, but then there wasn't the evidence base to back all of them up. And they knew that they would get jumped all over by the fishing industry if they went ahead with a policy that couldn't be completely backed up.
So is this part of your experience in this area, Dave? Have you... are you involved in sort of, have you been discussing, involved in sort of organisations and groups of people or policy, or meetings, for example, where you end up discussing these issues with lots of
troopers? I've had more dealings on the Scottish Marine Protected Area project, which is... Yeah, certainly. You know, looking at the Scottish Whitefish Producers Association, they're all just all over the MPA proposals, to, you know, saying, "Well, this isn't. We don't trust the evidence on this. This evidence has been produced by people who are biased." They're expecting the Scottish government not to use evidence that's been provided by NGOs. They want evidence from hopefully impartial people, you know, and. So they're quite switched on to this sort of stuff. The fishermen are an intelligent group of people. They have a lot of knowledge, and they're able to spot dodgy data pretty well, I think.
Mm-hmm. It must be kind of, looking at the policy point of view, it must be kind of an interesting place to be, or probably quite a difficult place to be, because especially over the last few years, there's been massive public pressure for marine protected areas at sea. It seems to be something that's quite a lot on the public consciousness at the moment. So I can imagine that maybe historically the fishing lobby's been huge, and the kind of the public lobby's been maybe slightly less. But in the last couple of years, especially with things like Hughes Fish Fight, you've got, you know, loads of people emailing the MEPs, emailing the local MPs, saying that this legislation has to go through, especially things with discarding bans, for example, that they really want to see something done. And it must be difficult with a given time frame to try and fit in either the policy or the science and evidence in place to actually provide the evidence to make sure that those policies are done correctly in the time frame that, say, the EU is given.
Yeah, the time frame for the Marine Strategy Framework Directive is very, very ambitious. You know, good environmental status by 2020. You know, we don't even know what the current status of a lot of these systems is. It's really incredibly tough timescale. But yeah, whether or not they're the public awareness of marine conservation is really like, I don't know. I had a really disturbing conversation with somebody who was generally interested in environmental things, who lived right on the shore of Loch Fyne. You know, he used to put his own creels out, you know, catch his own stuff. He was really interested in the environment. And I said, "Oh, this is going to be a marine protected area soon." And he said, "What's a marine protected area?" You know, he just had no idea. It was just not on his radar at all, you know. So, exactly who is getting, you know, how interested or knowledgeable people are in Scotland about marine protected areas and marine conservation, I don't know. Certainly the polling suggests that people are more concerned about pollution than they are about fishing, for instance. And pollution, you know, in a lot of ways is a sort of declining problem, whereas fishing, I say it's not a declining problem in a way.
I do agree with James, however, that public awareness has increased a lot with all the media in recent years.
So it seems very important to be able to identify the different parties involved. So, as I said, we've been, a lot of people around the table are scientists, but and a few have been involved in the policy making, but there's a whole range of other parties involved in the decision making process, and we're all members of the public. So there's also a public opinion about these issues as well, which is very important. I was wondering, I know that Lisa and Rodney are both involved in a group and organisation which is trying very hard to sort of establish good links between science and policy. Lisa, do you want to tell us a bit about that organisation, or
yep.
that grouping?
We're one of the three centres of expertise in Scotland, so it's a centres of expertise on animal disease outbreaks. It's called EPIC, so it's epidemiology, population infection and disease control.
I was trying to work out how that acronym.
Yeah, there's those small letters and big letters there, but we're funded specifically to respond to both emergency and non-emergency disease outbreaks, and in that context we directly provide advice to Scottish Government when they require it. And the challenge, I think what you were saying before, to come back to, is the time frame, is the tension between, sort of, if you like, the time frame of a policy cycle, which I think is somewhere between 3 and 5 years, versus the long time scale of research, and sort of balancing that to be able to provide emergency advice. So have the resilience of scientists to be in place who can respond to those short-term questions that are policy relevant questions, and yet at the same time also be doing interesting cutting edge science that balances out a scientist's career, which is really difficult.
So do you have scientists therefore that are are conducting research, and you then pick out that research and then sort of feed it to the policymakers in a digestible way? Or are the policymakers saying, you know, we want this science done? Can you get someone to work on this project for a while? Does it work both ways, or is it
a dialogue? It's very much a dialogue. So we have a situation where, so Rodney can come in on this, I think, but where you have a different groups of scientists who are all working on very long scale projects. The policymakers will have a specific policy question, and maybe that's something we can come back to later, because framing that question is very different from a policymaker's point of view. The scientist question might be quite a different question you want to ask. And then we have people like myself who are embedded in government to establish those communication links back and forth, so we can then change that question back to the researchers, people like Rodney, and then Rodney can then frame those answers, and we can help translate that answer from, say, a high-level science answer into a policy-relevant answer in the form of policy briefs. It's quite a different output, I think.
Yeah. So Rodney, how are you linked into this sort of organisation? What's your role?
Well, I guess there's two ways in which the policy side fits in with the science. So I'm working on combining science with social science to look at the spread of disease, which is interesting for two reasons. It's interesting for the scientists because it changes the advice that the scientists would give to policymakers. And it's interesting, I think, for the policymakers because the focus is on how people behave in the face of a disease outbreak. And behavior of the voters is going to be one of the things that politicians are, for example, are particularly interested in.
So you're involved in not just the sort of conducting the raw science and having that link to policy, but also trying to understand perhaps how some of these other parties might respond as well to such changes.
Yeah, so it fits right between, I mean, we're working in teams of both scientists and social scientists, and we have meetings where we have government policy people attending the meetings who are giving their views as we go along on what we're doing and what direction we should be going. So it's very much an integration of these different communities, the policy community, the straight science community, and a more social science community that sits in between policy and science.
So I say, going back to some of the stuff we were talking before, the marine protected areas, is there the same sort of setup? This organisation, the EPIC thing, seems to be quite focused on mixing the science and policy. Is there a similar thing going on in the marine science world?
There are a number of stakeholder workshops. How many were there? Five in the end?
For the Scottish project?
Yeah.
About that?
Yeah, five workshops that were supposed to bring together the sort of scientists and the industry people with the government. There's not a sort of centre of expertise for the marine environment in the same way as there is for disease and for climate change and for water resources is the other one. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there isn't one which is, there isn't anything really equivalent. There's a new one coming on fisheries management, which maybe will have this sort of role, but there isn't something that's directly equivalent for marine conservation.
This is within Scotland, but at European level there is. I'm thinking of the policy groups within ICES, for example.
ICES, yeah.
Yeah.
Which so what is that? What's the
very
what's
much
the
similarly?
What's ICES?
International Council for the Exploration of the Seas.
Thank you.
Yes.
So they have those regional grids within Europe that are set up for particular fisheries, and every year there's an ICES meeting where people get together and they discuss kind of particular issues with
that. Trying to bring
group
together lots of these. Different parties and policymakers and scientists, and trying to get them to interact more effectively. I imagine
it's been very fisheries led, I would have thought from the start. But
for the deep water environment, there are two, aren't there? There's the deep water fisheries one, and there's a deep water environment one, which is more to do with these sort of vulnerable marine ecosystems. So that's but it's mostly focused on what the effects of fishing would be on those ecosystems, really.
And probably a less sciencey one, a more stakeholder-led one, there's the RACS Regional Advisory Councils, where fishermen and NGOs and policymakers get together and discuss problems.
So it sounds very easy to set up these groups. There seems to be a lot of them.
Yeah, it's very complicated.
And it becomes very complicated very quickly. It'd be interesting now to see, so Katie is working in, not necessarily very much in the UK, but other countries and developing countries particularly. What do you find, you know, how is it similar, how is it different to what you've been hearing around the table?
Well, some of the kind of structures for communicating science or communication between science and policymakers are definitely similar. So, for example, I was involved in science that was trying to inform the Indonesian government when there was an outbreak of rabies in Bali, and FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, were essentially the technical advisors and providing various financial assistance.
Is that UK organization?
No, FAO is a world organization. It's an international organization.
Okay.
And so they basically organized meetings between scientists, the national government of Indonesia, the local government of Bali, which is comprised of about 7 different local governments, and various kind of NGOs, non-governmental organisations and so on, and local important stakeholders, politicians and so on, where we had to communicate kind of the most effective strategy that we think they ought to take in the next few years. And there was very good interactions between the whole group there.
So was in terms of the science that was your evidence you're trying to provide, was that evidence that had been you looked at elsewhere, or was it a project you focused on Bali for a while, and then after like a couple of years you've been able to
We'd done previous research in other countries, which definitely provided a lot of guidance. But one of the problems was when we went to Bali, we were asked because of our previous research to help in Bali, but when we went to Bali, the first thing that people said was, but Bali's different, there's no one else, there's no way the rest of the world is going to behave like Bali. So they wanted evidence that was really context specific. And so we actually worked with local people there, local providers of data, and analysed that information and tried to guide them. But it was interesting how the context really changed the way we communicated the science and the kind of messages that we really needed to get across.
So that seems like a very good broad discussion of the different areas or different interactions between science and policy. We thought now, because many of our listeners are probably not directly involved in policy making or are probably not conducting a lot of science that can directly influence policy, it'd be interesting to know and get a feel for how a scientist can go about perhaps having an impact. So perhaps a good starting point is just to ask, is it enough to simply just do your research and then at the end of it, try and get press attention?
No, I don't think it's probably enough to wait to the end. I think you need to have a good sense, even if you're doing something that's very cutting edge, I think you have to have a good sense of what your main messages are. You need to be able to express them clearly in a way that's very accessible to the public and to other stakeholders, and you need to have a good sense of who your audience is, and by that being quite strategic about how those audiences can then take your message into the policy sphere.
So you do have to think about it quite carefully, because people can perhaps misinterpret messages or perhaps not quite get the right thing.
Yeah, so I've got a good example of that from Indonesia, where our aim as scientists that work on rabies control is ultimately to eliminate the disease. But in Bahasa Indonesian, the word elimination basically means to kill all the dogs. So in the context of rabies control, that's what that word means, which definitely doesn't control rabies. So we had to completely change our language and kind of learn how we could communicate the messages about our science, and also not use the word elimination, obviously, but think about the local social context, because there was pressure to kill a lot of dogs because it's a very immediate and visible thing that the government can do. But then again, lots of people don't want their dogs killed, so there was also a lot of kind of positive and negative interactions between people who'd been affected by rabies and people who didn't want their dogs killed, and then trying to get the science in an objective way to this audience who were feeling very emotive about the subject was difficult.
That's a very interesting point, is that perhaps even if you wanted to just use the media as an avenue, you have to be very careful about the message you send out, and also perhaps, and also I suppose be quite realistic about what you can actually achieve through having a particular message. So, Sophie Day, have you had much experience with sort of conducting, so if you have, you conduct your science, you sort of send, you have a message you want to send to a policymaker. Is it easy to do? How much do you have to think about it en route to that point?
There are a couple of different ways that this has happened with me. Sometimes you get, you're doing work that the policy teams have actually asked you to do in the first place, and that can sometimes come from them having pressure from their from other stakeholders. So our cabinet secretary for the environment in Scotland, he was getting a lot of pressure from fishing industry to sort out the fisheries on the west coast. So he was getting lent on by the fishermen, so he lent on Marine Scotland, who then convened a group of people to try and help them come up with answers for that. So in that case, you know that the stuff you're doing is, you know, it's been commissioned by the policy people, so it's going to go straight back to them, and they'll do whatever they want with it afterwards. You can't help but the work get to the people who need it. So whether they do anything with it afterwards is a whole other question.
So I suppose for a scientist, in getting into the position where they come to you and ask, is how were you involved in such a way that they did they know about your research, or did you let them know about your research so that they knew that you were a good person to be on this panel
or
committee?
It wasn't because of my particular expertise in that subject, but I was known to the people who were convening it as being okay. Which is weird, I know. But it was, you know, they're very, in my experience, they're quite careful about who they go with. They like ex-government scientists, for instance. They end up working a lot, you know, with people who used to be in government, who are now in academia, other people that they kind of know through another context or something like that. That seems to be quite important.
Is that, do you think, through like a shared language? If you've got people that are very, very, who are already closely related to policy or ex kind of policymakers, you've got that ability to communicate much better than someone who's a complete blue sky scientist and has never dealt with a policymaker in their life.
I think so, and there's a certain amount of trust about how they're gonna act with the results, I guess, understanding the context a bit more, that sort of thing. In my case, I'd worked with somebody senior in Marine Scotland on a completely different sort of project, and as a result, when this came up, he recommended me as being part of the group, and since then there's been a succession of other sort of Marine Scotland funded projects as a result of that.
Yes.
But it's definitely comes from being known, I guess, personally rather than just through your publications.
It's the relationships, isn't it? It's the relationships that you have with people, because that's what allows you then, because you trust each other, and it's established that relationship early on, even before you have something you necessarily want to share. Allows you to be able to share it when the timing, you hit the right timing, and then there's some sort of serendipity in that.
I guess that's the case for my PhD. In fact, I was recommended by someone from Scottish Natural Heritage to government, and I got some funding for my PhD through that mechanism.
That's quite a nice direct example of how these interactions can facilitate science as well, and it is obviously a lot more than just as a scientist saying, here's a message. So you actually do have to sort of think about establishing these links and interacting with people who could make policy better. So I mean, and it's not just, I suppose it's not just the government as well, it's also these sorts of about organized bigger organizations as well, I think, isn't it? Kate, I think you mentioned you also have to try and, you're trying to sort of alter sort of perhaps the policies or influence the policies of big organisations.
Yeah, yeah. So like the World Health Organisation, the Food and Agriculture Organisation, if we can get taken seriously by them, then they write guidance documents which national governments all around the world pay attention to, and that can kind of form the basis of their policies.
The question is, you know, do governments really pay attention to all of these? So an example here is the World Bank recently released a report just at the beginning of the month that shows that only, I think it's 31% of any reports they've written were ever downloaded. So, and only, I think, not the figure here, but it's like 87% of their reports were never cited.
So I think that I can understand the reports just sit on shelves and get dusty,
yeah.
But that's definitely, again, where the personal relationship really helps, because you have time to talk to the person who's influential in government or in an organisation. And what I would say about that is, typically you have a message that you want to convey, your science says this is the thing that you should do, and you need to find as many ways of saying the same thing as possible, because each time you say it, maybe someone will listen or someone will take it on board, but a lot of the time it won't be. But once you've said it enough times in enough ways, then hopefully someone gets the message.
So if you've got a message from your project or a message from a particular paper, it's a case of going around and saying that message as many times as you can to, and I'm thinking, you know, not just to policymakers, but to other research groups, and just getting things out there in an attempt to try and disseminate your research. And I guess that's one of the main things that we're trying to do anyway, not just with science and policy, but with science in general, is the better we can disseminate our message, the more people that hear about our work, the more kind of exposure,
impact.
The more impact you'll get.
Yes, that's true.
With governments becoming much more sort of reflexive, and they're very interested in stakeholder values and interests. So if you have things like these types of podcasts where you're disseminating a message that really taps into one of those things, and some the right person hears it, they track that back in, and all of a sudden that becomes tabled at a meeting, at a stakeholder meeting, because government's always trying to bring those things into their policy making. So
it might be good to sort of begin to tie things up. Is there a key message we can take away from this? Apart from the fact that it's complicated. I mean, that's understandable. But say, again, for the novice scientist, the new the someone doing their PhD who might be interested in getting into policy, what do you think might be the key message? Let's just throw some ideas into it.
I think it's important to make sure you separate out opinion from fact.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really difficult. When you're asked your opinion on stuff, it's very flattering. Oh, wow, they think I'm so clever. You know, it's very, very dangerous, I think. Very difficult to separate out your opinions and your wishes for how something might be from what you can actually back up with the facts. I think it's a major pitfall. I'm guilty of it as anybody else, but try and avoid going from being an independent academic, which is a very kind of privileged position to be in, to being just another person with an opinion.
I think start off by keeping things simple, but also enable the detail to be accessed as well.
Anything else?
Just communication, good communication.
That's it. So those are three really good bits of advice, I think. And on that note, we should probably end and thank the people around the table for their contributions, and hopefully, if you're listening, thank you for listening, and we'll be back again soon. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook, you can find us on Twitter at the NS Podcast, and you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.